This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The new film Flight stars Denzel Washington as an airline pilot with substance abuse problems who performs brilliantly in a mid-air emergency to save scores of airline passengers. Six people die in the plane's crash landing, though, and afterward the pilot struggles with his addiction and whether he'll be held accountable for his drinking and drug abuse and blamed for the crash as well as credited for the heroic landing. Flight is directed by our first guest, Robert Zemeckis. His films include Romancing the Stone, three Back to the Future films, Forrest Gump, Contact, and Castaway. He also directed the innovative cartoon and live-action movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and has recently worked with cutting-edge motion capture technology in the films The Polar Express and Beowulf. Let's hear a clip from Flight, in which the pilot and his co-pilot are fighting to regain control of their plane as it plunges toward the ground.
This is SouthJet 227. We're in an uncontrolled dive. We got a jam stabilizer or something.
Oh, Lord, we're coming out of 7,000. I see nothing but acid.
When I say I want you to retract the flaps, retract the gear, trim us nose down, okay?
Trim down? What are you going to do?
Margaret, when I tell you I want you to push these forward, full throttle, can you do that?
Yeah.
Okay, when I
tell you... Wait, sir, what are we doing? Why would I trim down?
We're going to roll it, okay?
What do you mean roll it?
We got to do something to stop this dive. Here we go. I've got control.
Oh, Lord!
All right, Evans, flaps.
Flaps!
Speed brakes.
Speed brakes!
Margaret, power! Gear up.
Gear up!
Well, Robert Zemeckis, welcome to Fresh Air. I think the thought of air crashes holds a special terror for everybody who's been in an airplane, which is most of us these days. You are a pilot yourself. Have you ever been in a dicey situation where you weren't sure you were going to make it back?
Well, you know, I never thought of that. I am a pilot. I had an emergency situation on takeoff once, and where I lost engine power on takeoff, which is not a good thing because you're very close to the ground. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to keep the engine running. I was able to make a shallow turn and land on the same runway I took off on. But I would not want to be in those situations, that's for sure. But, you know, when a situation like that happens to you as a pilot, you really don't think about consequences. You just start thinking about all the things that you have to do, your training, if you will.
The effects on this are pretty amazing. I mean, you completely buy that this is happening, and you see it from many angles. And you did this on a relatively small budget for this kind of thing, $31 million.
Yeah,
I'm sure there's a long, complicated answer here, but how do you make it so real?
Well, you know, the short answer is I really pay a lot of attention to keeping the point of view of all this action coming from the place of character and keeping the audience with the main character. So we've set up basically these four people, these two flight attendants and the pilot and the co-pilot. And we see this incident basically from their point of view and, you know, not try to start introducing panicking passengers or that sort of thing and keep them basically as atmosphere and keep the drama with the main characters.
Now, it's not a spoiler to note that the pilot, Denzel Washington, whose name is Whip Whitaker, has problems. I mean, he's a substance abuser. He drinks alcohol and takes other drugs. We see this in the opening scene, and that sets up the story. I thought we'd listen to a clip here where this is after the crash, and six people died, two crew members and four passengers, but everybody else survived, which was, you know, due to this captain's remarkable maneuver in the air to bring the plane down. And this is a meeting where he's sitting down at a restaurant and kind of discovering what a serious situation he might be in. He's meeting with an old friend, a union representative and an old Navy buddy who is played by Bruce Greenwood. And he has brought an attorney who's played by Don Cheadle. And they're talking about what these guys are going to be facing. We'll hear Denzel Washington, the pilot, speaking first.
So why do we need a lawyer from Chicago?
He who specializes in criminal negligence.
Criminal negligence?
Mm-hmm. Death demands responsibility. Six dead on that plane. Someone has to pay.
I flew the plane inverted. That means upside down. You have any idea what that's like?
I do. I heard the black box recordings last night.
Oh, you heard? Saw you a pilot?
No, I'm not.
Then you don't know what you're talking about. All right, let's cut to the chase. Just tell me what it is I need to know, Charlie.
The NTSB GO team also collects blood, hair, and skin samples. An initial report shows that you had alcohol in your system.
Mm. Thank you. So that was, didn't mean anything. I had a couple of beers the night before the flight.
This toxicology report states that you were drunk. And if it is proven that your intoxication was the cause of the death of the four passengers, now we're going to look at four counts of manslaughter. That could be life in prison.
And that's Don Cheadle speaking with Denzel Washington and Bruce Greenwood in the film Flight, directed by our guest Robert Zemeckis. You know, one of the most dramatic moments in this film, and this is really about direction, I mean your work, is in a hotel room, and it's of a hand taking a single serving size bottle of vodka from the top of a mini bar. Now, I don't know whether you want to talk about this. I don't want to give away anything critical.
Sure.
But you want to talk about making that moment so powerful?
Well, that's what I love about this art form. It's cinema. And I just love the idea that you can take an inanimate object like a single service, you know, vodka bottle and make it into a character. I was channeling Hitchcock, I guess, you know, when I was doing that scene, I was thinking, okay, how can I make this suspenseful? It's just this guy in a minibar in a hotel room. And thinking about that scene and having him have to approach the refrigerator and open the refrigerator. So I designed the refrigerator so that we had actual lights inside the walls of the refrigerator so that it would glow like a jewel box with all the alcohol in there. And
but the question was, would he take a drink or not? And so
would he take a drink? That's what the audience was. And you didn't know if he was going to do it or not. And that was the setup. And so, you know, and then I shot it at different frame rates and had the camera kind of like ease into that bottle at the end. And yeah, I just sort of tried to make it as cinematic and as suspenseful as I possibly could.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you almost jump in your seat because he's not going to drink and then the bottle disappears in a big swoosh.
Right.
People write about the economics of the business to some extent about in these things. I read that this was a relatively inexpensive film, $31 million, that you and Denzel Washington both were so committed that you waived your fees. I don't know if this is the kind of thing you like to talk about in interviews,
sure,
but you were, in other words, the point was you were willing to kind of take whatever you got on the back end just to get it made. And I read that you said it was great to be making an inexpensive movie. Why?
Yes. Well, you know, because, you know, what's wonderful about making an inexpensive movie is you can try things. And when I started making this film, I realized that what I had been, you know, it's great when you've got a large budget and you have this huge army to realize your vision. You know, you've got every piece of equipment that you can possibly imagine on the truck, and you can design and have sets built that are very elaborate and visual effects and that sort of thing. That's all wonderful, but you realize that that's a huge responsibility. So you have to be very cautious in everything that you do, so you can't take any risks because, you know, there's too much money involved. So you have to play it very, very close to the vest. And I think that by having what I'll call a responsible budget, you can try things, because the worst thing that's going to happen is at the moment may not work. And it's, you know, and the whole film isn't going to live or die on that moment. And if you went down the road and you made a film that absolutely no one in the world had any interest in seeing, then it wasn't a complete horrible disaster that was going to maybe, you know, bankrupt an entire studio. It was liberating.
Now, you were an early collaborator with Steven Spielberg. How did you get into his orbit?
I was very fortunate to be riding on the sort of in the slipstream of these young guys who were coming out of film school who were the sort of new wave in Hollywood. It was like George Lucas and Francis Coppola and John Milius and Steven Spielberg. And, you know, in the New York contingent of that was Martin Scorsese and Brian De Palma. And I met Steven at the USC Film School. He came down with one of his early films, Sugarland Express. And I struck up a conversation with him. And I said, hey, would you like to see a student film I made? And he said, sure. And I called him at his office. And he set up a screening in a screening room at Universal, and he saw my film I made, and he thought it was really good. And we kept in touch. And then my partner and I, my writing partner, Bob Gale, we wrote a screenplay which became 1941, which actually was developed by John Milius, who thought it was an outrageous idea and got us the money to develop it. And he was good friends with Steven, so he gave the screenplay to Steven. Steven read it, loved it, and said he wanted to do it. And so then all of a sudden Bob Gale and myself were on the set of Close Encounters working on his next screenplay with him. And so that's sort of how our relationship sort of started, is all through the work.
Now, I read that you made a couple of early films, I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is about some young women trying to get in to see the Beatles, and mm-hmm. Used Cars, which were critical but not commercial successes. And the big breakout film, I guess, for you was Back to the Future, which you wrote with your friend Bob Gale. This is an interesting, you know, it's a fun film because it's about time travel, but it's really about these relationships, right? About this guy going and meeting his parents when they were teenagers.
Right. Yeah, the initial germ of the idea was never about the science fiction of it. The idea was Bob and I were kicking around the idea, and Bob said one day, I wonder if I would have been my father's friend if I were in high school with him. And we were thinking about our relationships with our fathers, and he said that, and he said, yeah, and then sort of think, yeah, wouldn't it be interesting if a teenage kid went back in time and met his parents as teenagers? And that was the germ of the idea.
I read that the studios were nervous about it because it was a little too soft for some studios that were doing, you know, a lot of racy stuff, except for Disney, who thought it was a little too hardcore because a guy kisses his mom.
Right. They were worried about the Oedipo implications. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I have a very wonderful file of rejection letters from every studio passing on Back to the Future. I kept them all.
And the amazing thing is you get it funded and you shoot 5 weeks with Eric Stoltz in the lead role, right? And then had to reverse course. What happened?
Well, it was being an inexperienced director. Eric is a magnificent actor, but the comedy sensibilities of what I was doing and his sensibility as an actor just weren't working. He wasn't understanding where the humor was that I was seeing in the piece. Now, you know, it's my responsibility because I cast Eric, and I didn't do it for the right reasons, if you know what and I'm about to explain what that is. And that is I was ordered by the studio to start the movie on a specific day. And basically I was told, if you don't start it on this day, we're not going to make the movie because we want it out for the summer. And so I learned a very, very hard lesson, which is, you know, don't ever do anything for the wrong reasons. And the actor I really wanted was Michael J. Fox, but he wasn't available. And I was given this ultimatum to start, because he was doing his TV show, to start it on this day. So I thought, okay, I can make this movie work with Eric. And it wasn't Eric, you know, it had nothing to do with Eric's ability, but I wasn't seeing the movie working. And so I assembled all the film that I had, and I ran it for Steven, and I said, you know, I don't think this is working. And he said, you're right, it's not working. And he says, well, what are we going to do? And so we went to the studio and said, we want to reshoot. And they thought I was – the head of the studio at the time literally said to me, sir, he said, you are insane. He said, you are insane. And I guess I just sort of shrugged. But, you know, they backed my decision and allowed me to go and reshoot those 5 weeks and cast Michael J. And he worked literally 24 hours a day, working all day on his TV series. And we shot everything with him at night, and he never slept. And we went back and reshot all those weeks of shooting.
We can't talk about all of your films or we'd be here all day, but I did want to bring up this other memory from one that's a memorable film. And rather than introduce it, let's just play it. Let's just hear this moment.
Cigars, cigarettes, Eddie Valiant.
Benny?
Long time no see.
What are you doing here?
Work's been kind of slow since cartoons went to color. But I still got it, Eddie. Boop, boop, be-doop.
Yeah, you still got it.
bring back a memory?
Yeah, yeah, that's Betty Boop in glorious black and white.
That, of course, is from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Mae Questel played Betty Boop, and the detective Eddie Valiant is played by Bob Hoskins. I mean, this was a really remarkable film, and you know, a lot of people remember it, I bet, as being amazing, and probably it's long enough ago that they don't remember it so well. I mean, this was where we have these cartoon characters who are toons, people who are these creatures in 1947 Los Angeles and kind of live in a seedy part of town and interact in live action with real characters. It would have been just a gag if there weren't like a really interesting story and characters here. And this was the first time anybody had done this. And I know there's probably a long, complicated answer to this too, but how did you make it look so real in 1988?
Well, there were two artists, I guess, and one rule that we violated. One, I had a magnificent director of animation, Richard Williams, who was a very rebellious expatriate Canadian who lived in London, and he was just a great animator. And Ken Ralston, who was the effects supervisor at ILM. And what Ken Ralston was able to do is he was able to come up with, devise a way to put like this three-dimensional painting on each cell of animation that would match the lighting that we did in the set to give the cartoon characters the same sort of feel of the actual practical lighting that were on the human characters. And then Richard Williams was, you know, I said to him, I said, well, you know, what's never been done in these animation, live action movies is that they've never moved the camera. I mean, if you look at the scenes in Mary Poppins or in Pete's Dragon or any of those, they always lock the camera off. And he said, yeah, well, that's, you know, how to, you know, we don't, you know, it's so difficult to draw the different changes of perspective, and would they feel like they're floating, and all these rules about you can never move the camera. And he said, but let's do it anyway. Let's move the camera. And so in all these scenes with the cartoon characters, I just shot the movie like I would any live action movie. And the animators actually found that it worked better by having the camera moving, that they were able to actually give more life to the cartoon characters and have them feel like they're more integrated into the actual two-dimensional set. So it was that. It was like doing something that no one ever had ever done before, which gives it that sort of ability to suspend your disbelief about this whole kind of weird thing that you're looking at.
So you'd shoot the live-action scenes first, and if
yes.
You had a cartoon that would later be throwing something in the real world, like a plate or a cup, you'd have to figure out a way to make the plate or cup
right.
move. Then later right. The animators come back in and fill in the animation. How long did it take to do all this?
Well, it took a really long time. No, it was a long shooting schedule. It was probably over 100 days that we shot. But that's what we had an army of puppeteers who would puppeteer anything physical that a cartoon character was holding, whether it was a gun or a mallet or anything like that. And they would be articulating that. And then we would have to shoot the set empty with just this gun floating around on wires. And then, you know, Bob Hoskins would have to find what I would, you know, we would find an eye line for him to be talking to the rabbit. And then he would have to perform. But we had the voice performers for the cartoon characters off camera on the set. So they were actually doing the scene with another actor's voice in real time. So that was also a help.
So, but
and then later we'd go back and animate the character and back the animation into the live action, we call the background plate.
And so, but Bob Hoskins had to imagine who he was talking to. It was a voice, but he had to just, what, hallucinate a
right.
rabbit?
Right. Well, Charlie Fleischer was the voice of Roger Rabbit, and he was on the set every day, and he demanded a costume. So we dressed him up as the wardrobe department actually made a Roger Rabbit costume for him so that he could go into wardrobe every morning. And he had the red trousers and a big bow tie, and he had that on. And then I had these rubber dolls made to scale of the cartoon characters, and I would place them in the set, and we would rehearse the scene, and I would walk around holding the rabbit by its ears, bouncing around the set, and Bob would find places in the set where I would move the rabbit, and he would then move his eyes to those areas and remember where they were, and then he would focus them on a point in space because he couldn't look at the wall or a target out of frame, because then the camera would see that he would be looking through the cartoon character and it would destroy the illusion. So it was a lot of work, but the secret to the blend between animation and live action working was the performances of the live action characters.
You've always been interested in changing movie technology. I mean, you did a lot of stuff with motion capture, Polar Express, Beowulf. Are you a gadget guy, or you just, I don't know, do these things bring things you want to explore and play with?
I'm not a gadget guy. I don't have gadgets. I love the illusion of cinema, and I like the spectacle of cinema, which I think is what movies are supposed to do. And I like having the newest tools at my disposal. You know, I love presenting to the company, okay, how can we do this? How can we do this in a way that it hasn't been done before? I like the challenge of that. So, you know, I believe that cinema, that movies have always been a technical art form. And I think that my favorite quote is the one from Francois Truffaut, where he said, a really, really good movie is the perfect blend of truth and spectacle. So I think you do both. And that's what makes movies entertaining, is you give the audience a way to look at something or see something that they've never seen before. And that's where the illusion and the special effects and all the technology come in. And then you give them, you know, a story that's got some human truth. And when you can blend them together, that's a very entertaining movie.
Do you think digital technology has sort of fundamentally changed movie making? I mean, even in films that really don't involve special effects?
Oh, yeah. But that's because everything always did from day one. I mean, you know, you can go back and see how, you know, in the final years of the silent cinema, where the art of cinema storytelling was so magnificent. And then when they invented the microphone and sound, everything got really static. And it all had to be reinvented again. And same when color came in. And when they invented the Steadicam, every movie had a chase up and down a staircase, you know. So what we do with these new technologies is we overuse them and we call attention to them because there's just so much fun to have. And then we learn how to use them in the way that all tools of cinema should be used, which is to make them invisible. So now I don't think you can even tell when a director is using a Steadicam. So, yeah, I think that, some of the digital stuff that we're doing now, especially in editing, I find that there's editing for what I call no reason. You know, we just edit to edit. And I think we do that in films now because we can. But we'll get that out of our system and then something else will be there that'll be the new technology of the month.
Well, Robert Zemeckis, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Robert Zemeckis directed the new film Flight, starring Denzel Washington. You can hear the full interview, which aired last Thursday, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Buddy Miller and Jim Lauderdale are two singer-songwriters who've each written hits for numerous country and rock artists and have had their own extensive solo careers as performers and producers. The new album, Buddy and Jim, is their first collaboration. It's a mixture of original songs and covers of songs from earlier decades of country, rock, folk, and soul music. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
I've been up so high, I've been down so low, but you followed me every way I go. I've been out so far, you're still here so far. You could be anywhere, but here we are, always there. Yes, we are.
That's a Buddy Miller, Jim Lauderdale original, a plaintive weeper called That's Not Even Why I Love You. Although they've worked with big names as various as Robert Plant and George Strait, Miller and Lauderdale have never become big stars in their own right, and a song like that may suggest why. They enjoy a good pity party, a well-crafted downer that takes its time before it gets to the hook. In this sense, they're throwbacks to an earlier era of country music. when another new song they've written, Looking for a Heartache Like You, would have been a honky-tonk hit in the 50s and 60s.
Here I go again, got myself in trouble. Show me signs so subtle, I think you ought to spend more time inside my bubble. Looking for a heartache like you. I'm looking for a heartache like you. Here's to everyone.
Both Lauderdale and Miller have rough, urgent voices. Their harmonies are nice and vinegary, not surgingly interconnected the way true old country brother acts such as the Leuven Brothers and the Wilburn Brothers were. If they don't share the genes, though, they connect through shared emotion in a song such as Lonely One in This Town, which has been recorded by acts ranging from the Mississippi Sheiks to the Lovin' Spoonful's John Sebastian.
I'm a lonely one in this town. Everybody tried to throw me.
This album is all over the map, from the country blues of The Train That Carried My Gal From Town, reminiscent of Frank Hutchison's recording in the 1920s, to a 50s rockabilly blaster called The Wobble. But it's in the broken-hearted ballads that the duo does its best work, here offering an impressively forthright admission of pain in interpreting a song from Buddy Miller's musical wife Julie on It Hurts Me.
When I look in your eyes and they're telling me lies, it hurts me. When your passions grow old and your kisses grow cold, it hurts me. I long ever to be your only desire.
Ultimately, Buddy and Jim see their job as describing variations on heartache and desolation. But the trick is to render these emotions with sufficient energy, a kind of lust for melancholy, that keeps you coming back for more.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Buddy and Jim. Coming up, Hilary Mantel talks about her best-selling historical novels Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, about the reign of King Henry VIII. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Say that nothing lasts forever, honey, I've got news. Whoever said that never got the blues from you. This cloud I'm under looks like it's gonna stay. The thunder's gonna roll forever and a day. Nothing's gonna change the way I think and feel. My heart is so heavy and my fate is sealed.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Hilary Mantel, is the author of the best-selling novel Wolf Hall, about the reign of King Henry VIII in 16th-century England. The novel ends with the beheading of Henry's counselor, Lord Chancellor Thomas More, after More opposed the king's decision to break from the Roman Catholic Church so he could divorce his wife Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. It didn't work out so well for Boleyn. Her beheading provides the ending to Mantel's best-selling sequel, Bring Up the Bodies. Both books are told from the perspective of Thomas Cromwell, Henry's chief minister. Mantell's third volume will end with Cromwell's execution. Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies each won Britain's most prestigious literary award, the Man Booker Prize. Wolf Hall also won the American National Book Critics Circle Award for fiction. Terry spoke with Mantell last Monday.
Hilary Mantell, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your second Man Booker Prize. It's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you.
So I'd love to start with a reading from the new book, Bring Up the Bodies. And this is toward the very end of the book, when Anne Boleyn is getting executed. And there are many executions in your books. The first book ends with an execution, and so does the second. So before you read this passage, I'd like you to just explain what's happening and who is speaking in the passage that you're going to read.
Well, we first of all have Thomas Cromwell, who is Henry's chief minister and the organizer of the plot to bring down Anne Boleyn. Henry has sent for the executioner from Calais to behead his wife with the sword rather than the customary axe, in the hope it will give her a quicker death. So we have Cromwell, we have the French executioner, and we have Christophe, a young ruffian who is a servant to Cromwell. The weapon is heavy, needing a two-handed grip. It's almost 4 foot in length, 2 inches broad, round at the tip, a double edge. One practices like this, the executioner says. He whirls like a dancer on the spot, his arms held high, his fists together as if he were gripping the sword. Every day one must handle the weapon, if only to go through the motions. One may be called at any time. We do not kill so many in Calais, but one goes to other towns. It is a good trade, Christophe says. He wants to handle the sword, but he, Cromwell, does not want to let go of it yet. The man says, they tell me I may speak French to her, and she will understand me. Yes, do so, Cromwell says. But she will kneel. She must be informed of this. There is no block, as you see. She must kneel upright and not move. If she is steady, it will be done in a moment. If not, she will be cut to pieces. He hands back the weapon. I can answer for her. The executioner says, between one beat of the heart and the next, it is done. She knows nothing. She is in eternity. They walk away. Christophe says, Master, that man has said to me, tell the women that she should wrap her skirts about her feet when she kneels, in case she falls bad and shows off to the world what so many fine gentlemen have already seen. He does not reprove the boy for his coarseness. He is crude, but correct. When the moment comes, it will prove. The women do it anyway. They must have discussed it among themselves.
Thank you for reading that. And that's Hilary Mantell reading from the end, not the very end, but near the end of her latest novel, Bring Up the Bodies, which won the Man Booker Award, Britain's highest literary prize. You just kind of shiver hearing that passage. And it just made me think, you know, about executions. Like, the, it makes the guillotine seem very humane by comparison. You know, where you're describing that if she moves, if Anne Boleyn moves while the sword's coming down, that, you know, she'll be cut to pieces. As it won't be a swift death.
Yes, they were asking her to do something very difficult, which was to remain absolutely still in the knowledge of what was coming. But the executioner was a man who obviously knew his trade, and what he did was to approach Anne from an angle that she wasn't expecting. She was blindfolded and she couldn't hear him because he was wearing soft slippers. And it happened before she knew. And she did remain kneeling upright. Usually executions were with the axe and the sufferer put their head on a block. But Henry thought that this was a more skillful, humane way of doing it. It's strange that he should have such a scruple at the last moment.
This is very thoughtful if you're executing your wife to do it so humanely.
Yes, it seems strange to us, doesn't it? But for a while, the people at the Tower of London didn't know whether Anne was to be beheaded or burned. And, you know, typical bureaucrats, they're sending frantic notes saying, what kind of scaffold have we to build? When you look at it through the bureaucratic language, it all becomes even more chilling, because to them, it's just an administrative problem. They just want to get things done efficiently. After all, it's not every day that one executes a Queen of England.
So I'm not sure if this is something you've thought about before or not, but I know that you wrote, I think it was your very first book, about the French Revolution.
And, sure.
And now you've written about Henry VIII, and you know, there are several beheadings in these books. So, excuse me for asking this, but if you had to be beheaded centuries ago, would you have preferred the guillotine or the axe or sword customarily used in England?
Well, it's a strange question.
I thought so.
But I'm quite prepared to answer that. I think the guillotine never failed, you know, whereas the headsman occasionally, as in fact in the case of the execution of Thomas Cromwell himself, was either not expert enough or maybe having a bad day, and the whole thing could take a long time. At least the guillotine was over in seconds.
And Cromwell will be executed in the final book in your trilogy, which you're writing now.
Yes, 1540. The final book covers his rise and rise. He's a long way to go yet. And then his sudden fall and execution in the summer of 1540.
You know, I was thinking if anyone ever needs an antidote to princess fantasies, they might want to read your books.
Yes.
Women who were chosen as queen, that sounds really great, right? But if they don't give birth to a male heir for Henry VIII, bam, they're executed.
I don't think it's as simple as that, in all fairness.
Okay.
He didn't execute his first wife for failing to give birth to a male heir. He divorced her. He didn't execute Anne for that reason. But Anne had become a political liability, a diplomatic liability. And Henry did believe, rightly or wrongly, that there was a plot against him, a plot to kill him, and that Anne was implicated. It sounds unlikely, it sounds far-fetched, but the court was, I won't say happy, but they were able to go along with it.
Of all the historical stories that you could tell in historical fiction, why did you choose the stories of Cromwell, Henry VIII, and Henry VIII's wives?
The three books really are about Cromwell. They center on him. They're seen through his eyes. What Cromwell doesn't know, by and large, the reader doesn't know. That is, at least when you're within the framework of the narrative. Obviously, you bring your historical knowledge to it. But Cromwell is the primary figure here. And this is a great untold story, or at least it wasn't told until now. Because all the fiction and all the drama we have about Henry VIII's reign, and the figure of Cromwell is somehow marginal or missing. And yet he was central, and historians know that, but it just hadn't percolated through to fictionalized narratives. He's the minister of everything. He's Henry's right hand, and he's powerful for almost 10 years. But strangely, because he has been left out of the popular narrative, when you look through Cromwell's eyes, this material, which seems so very familiar to us, becomes unfamiliar. You have a different angle. But everything in the book, Anne, Queen Catherine, Henry, they all seem from Cromwell's point of view. So this is not a neutral portrayal. It's not an overview. It's very angled.
So Henry VIII breaks off from the Roman Catholic Church, starts the Church of England. Parliament makes Henry the head of the church, but Cromwell's really running the church. So outside, you know, Henry breaks away from the Roman Catholic Church in order to divorce his wife. Outside of changing, you know, the rule about divorce, are there other changes that Henry and Cromwell make in the Church of England?
Well, I think Henry's divorce is really only one part of it. If you think of the enormous advantages that the break from Rome brought to England, because it meant basically for Henry that he could lay his hands on the church's assets. So it wasn't simply a question of getting rid of his first wife. It was a question, as he saw it, of taking ownership of what really should be his anyway. You see, what you had in England before the Reformation were essentially two jurisdictions running side by side, the English jurisdiction and the Roman jurisdiction. No, this is a time of the formation of a nation. Cromwell certainly is intent on an independent England, a country that runs her own affairs and runs them in the English language by and large, not in Latin, and has the Bible in English. That was his great crusade. The law on divorce didn't change. There was actually no such thing as a divorce. There was only an annulment, a declaration that a marriage had never been lawful in the first place. This is what Henry sought. Now, when Rome wouldn't give him that annulment, then there was a big rethink, and it was the precipitating cause, but not the sole cause, of the break with Rome. Henry then had his new Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Cranmer, and the decision had been taken back from Rome to England. So Henry was granted his divorce, his annulment, under the new English jurisdiction.
Is the Bible translated from Latin into English during the period of Henry VIII and in part as a result of Henry VIII?
Yes, it is. And this is a great turning point. In 1538, a time which will be covered in my third book, Cromwell actually gets Henry's blessing for the English Bible to be placed in every parish church. This is for the first time. There had been English Bibles a few years before, but they were not licensed by the king. Their status was unofficial. But Cromwell actually managed to get, eventually, Henry's commitment to the scriptures in English. And the decree was that anyone who could read could come up and read that Bible. So it's a great turning point, because it's giving what people thought of as the word of God to the people in their own language.
Why do you write historical fiction? And I know you haven't exclusively written that, but you're certainly best known for that.
Since I was a very small child, I've had a kind of reverence for the past, and I felt a very intimate connection with it. When I began, it was just being enthralled by the lives of the members of my family. I'm one of these children who grew up at the knee of my grandmother and her elder sister, listening to very old people talk about their memories. And as I say, in their conversation, everything was as if it happened yesterday, and the dead were discussed along with the living, and the difference really didn't seem to matter. And I suppose this seeped into my viewpoint. Instead of thinking there was a wall between the living and the dead, I thought there was a very thin veil. It was almost as if they'd just gone into the next room.
Now, there are certain like inherent problems with historic fiction, which is, look, for the reader, unless you really know your history, you never know if what you're reading is the novelist taking liberty or, the best interpretation of history that we have. That line between fact and fiction is often blurred in historic fiction. What guides you about that line between fact and fiction when you're writing?
It's quite simple, really. I make up as little as possible. I spend a great deal of time on research, on finding all the available accounts of a scene or incident, finding out all the background details and the biographies of the people involved there. And I try to run up all the accounts side by side to see where the contradictions are and to look where things have gone missing. And it's really in the gap, it's in the erasures, that I think the novelist can best go to work. Because inevitably in history, in any period, we know a lot about what happened, but we may be far hazier on why it happened. And there's always the question, why did it happen the way it did? Where was the turning point? Every scene I go into, I'm looking for these contradictions, antagonisms, and I'm trying to find out the dramatic structure of history, if you like.
Well, Hilary Mantel, congratulations on your books and the Man Booker prizes, and thank you so very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Hilary Mantel speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. Mantel's new historical novel is called Bring Up the Bodies. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.